Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi there, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And you know, pasta is that wonderful food that is intrinsically joined to Italy. I mean, I don't think there's any way that anyone would deny that. But it is such a popular food that it is almost considered American, and I think everybody has at least one pasta meal a week or a month if they're not avoiding carbs. It's too delicious to avoid. And someone who knows a lot about pasta is here with me today, and she can debunk some of the myths that you might have thought about how to cook pasta, but also shed some light on the history and particularly on the methods of cooking and saucing our pasta, as well as history of food in Rome, and totally. Maureen Fant. Maureen, welcome.
Thank you, Linda.
Maureen is an author of many books. Well, she started out as an archaeologist, but we'll let her tell us about that. Archaeology and food history, that's the same thing. They're both building blocks, right, of human culture.
They are. They're both ways of looking at a whole culture, of the material record of a culture.
Absolutely. And Maureen is the author of several books. I don't know how many books. Trattorias, the Encyclopedia of Food, Dictionary of Italian Food, and has translated the work of Oretta Zanini De Vita, the Encyclopedia of Pasta and the Food of Rome and Lazio, and list goes on. But this most recent book that you have written with Oretta.
Yes, it's co-authored.
It co-authored with Oretta is Sauces and Shapes.
Pasta the Italian Way.
Pasta the Italian Way. I wanted to get that right, and I didn't have my glasses on. And it is such a successful book. I mean, it won the IACP award this year and
yes,
was
in
a
the
finalist
international.
In the International Cookery.
Yes.
And was a finalist in the same category for the James Beard Awards. And congratulations.
Thank you.
I have a question. Do you think, because you talk a lot about in the book about making the pastas, the actual dough by hand, do you think this book would have had success, say, 10, 15 years ago before people were so into, you know, making all this food themselves, the whole artisanal movement and all?
Probably the pasta part would have been about the same. What would have been different 10 years ago, in fact, we couldn't have written this book 10 years ago, maybe 10, 15 certainly not, because we are such sticklers for the ingredients in the sauces. That's where the book in many ways is very new, even though it's very traditional. You can order anchovies. If you can't get them where you live, you can order the good anchovies. You can order salt-packed capers from Pantelleria. You can get all these ingredients now. And it used to be impossible.
That's interesting. We had a discussion earlier before the show about how difficult years ago it was to find simple things like Parmesan and prosciutto that people now take for granted.
Yes, yeah. And also good dry pasta, good industrial mm-hmm. pasta. Mm-hmm. And now you can get all kinds of very good pasta. It used to be impossible.
Well, aside from the ingredients, you really talk a lot about, I guess I would say, the culture of pasta.
The culture of pasta, yes, exactly.
And that is, I think, something that people don't understand. First of all, Italians have been eating pasta and cooking pasta for millennia, okay? Let's don't go back to, you know, to the early, you know, the early days, but as far as debunking the myth about the whole Marco Polo thing, we can
definitely can be debunked. Marco Polo did eat pasta in China, but as Loretta always says, when he got home to Venice, his wife had a bowl of pasta waiting for him. It was also known, he recognizes what he saw in China as pasta, so he knew it already before
right,
he went.
Right, right. And I want to say that I know in Oretta's past books, and I passed this phrase out to you before, she was always kind of like, seemed to me a pasta police person. And I mean, and you, I think that's rubbed off on you, and you just, anyone who's lived there and cooked in Italy becomes
Absolutely.
This way, right?
Absolutely. Well, Oretta is a real stickler for everything. She has a wonderful sense of humor. She's a delightful person, but you can't get away with anything with Oretta. And yes, I've become that way. But anybody who cooks, seriously, I'm a home cook. I'm not a trained chef. But I'm a good home cook. And once you get into that, you have your standards. And you do not let them down.
That's right. And I bring this up specifically because the title, Sauces, Shapes and Sauces, I mean, people used to think I was crazy when I said, no, you can't serve a bolognese sauce with
spaghetti.
Spaghetti, right. You know, certain shapes are made for certain sauces. There's a butter-based and a oil-based, and there's, of course, the permutations go on and on and on, which I'm going to hear from you.
All right. Well, first of all, the world of pasta divides, there's a sort of different lines of division. There's the whole grano tenero, soft wheat and egg universe, and there's the durum wheat and water universe, and there's a little bit of crossover, some with egg and some without egg, but basically the sfoglia, the sheet from which noodle shapes, flat noodle shapes, tagliatelle, lasagna, are cut, ravioli, are made with they're cut from the sfoglia, the sheet, they're made with eggs and grano tenero, soft wheat. The spaghetti, the extruded shapes, and also the more rustic handmade shapes usually from the south of Italy, central and southern Italy, are they're made with durum wheat and water. Now, usually, what can I say? The shapes and the sauces have definite partners, once people understand the principle that you can't serve everything with everything, they tend to overthink, and they look for scientific principles. And there are a few basic scientific principles, such as the more liquid the sauce, the more surface area you want on your pasta. So spaghetti, something long, goes very well with something liquid. I mean, it's almost obvious. But from there to why linguine is better with seafood and spaghetti is better with, I don't know, plain tomato sauce, there's no reason at all. It's tradition. Linguine is traditional with seafood. It's not that little teeny tiny difference in the shape is seeking out a shrimp for its natural partner. It's not. It's tradition. So you have to take a lot of it with a grain of salt, while never forgetting that you absolutely cannot serve just anything with anything.
Uh-huh. Not anything with anything.
So it's not simple. But
now, for those of you, I have to say that who are listening to Maureen talk so casually about knowing the intricacies of pasta, Maureen has lived in Italy. She went over years ago. It's been over 30 years. You've just been.
I have lived there since 1979.
Just lived there, and so she knows a thing or two about pasta. Right? How did you get in? And you went over initially to study archaeology and be a
yes.
world-famous archaeologist, right? How did you make that switch into food?
It was through writing. I was working as an editor at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, which is another approach to food, which has nothing to do with the luxury of how to make the perfect bolognese. But I was editing, which classics is excellent preparation for. And I decided that really I had to get back into the humanities, and I started writing for a magazine, Armchair Archaeology, or articles from a magazine in English that was published in Rome. And from there, I made some proposals to send some queries to the New York Times travel section. And one of them contained a food component. It was about Norcia, a town in Umbria known for its pork products.
Sausages, yes.
Sausages and, yeah. Also black truffles. But the editor, Nancy Newhouse, said, oh, you know, I'd like your ideas, but do the one on Norcia because I need food. And I did, and she liked it, and they began to give me food assignments. So when the New York Times decides that you write about food, you get busy, and you...
So they decided your future in a certain way.
Yes, yes. And then I realized that, you know, it's what I wanted to do, what I had always wanted to do, but I never thought anybody would want to read what I said about food, because there are so many good food writers out there.
Yeah, well, you have certainly made a mark for yourself. I was telling Maureen earlier that when on one of my trips, I found her book had just been published on the trattorias of Rome and Florence.
And Venice.
And Venice, right. And I grabbed that, and, you know, before I went to add a little substance to my wanderings around, and have been following your food writing ever since.
Well,
actually, first with the Dictionary of Italian Food.
Dictionary of Italian Cuisine,
that was
published
fun.
In the 1990s. And we're working on, my co-author and I have been picking at it all these years, and we're very close to coming out with an e-book, an electronic edition of the dictionary.
Well, that's good. People, since they travel with their iPads,
yes,
and their iPhones, and that's about it. Right.
Yes.
But you do keep your hand in some of the archaeology and certainly the cultural history.
I do. I translate sort of difficult excavation reports and things from the Italian, and my translations are in the Iraq Museum.
Oh, interesting.
I translated wall panels from the Iraq Museum for some of the restored rooms, because they were restored by Italian archaeologists, and the wall panels were written in Italian, and I translated them.
And you've also written a book that's been now in, it has had, three or four different editions, The Life of Women in Rome.
Women's Life in Greece and Rome. We are working with Mary Lefkowitz, who recently retired from teaching at Wellesley College. We are working on the fourth revised edition now. That book has been... I grew up with that book.
Mm.
It's amazing. But we're very proud of it. It's a source book. It's writings collected and extracted from Greek and Latin texts, translated, annotated.
So, of course, we knew that women had to cook. So why not then make that transition over to cooking? And back to the book Sauces and Shapes, you say in this, well, or in a couple of your interviews about the book, that there are a lot of myths. You don't say that there are myths. You know there are myths abound about what to do with pasta, how to cook pasta, mistakes people make, and you decided to put an end to a lot of that, right?
Myths and misconceptions, we could say.
Okay, and one of them, of course, is... And hard to believe, people cooking pasta, the first thing you have to do is salt the water, right?
People are very reluctant to use enough salt. Now, salt is one of these foods that's been demonized, and people are afraid to use enough salt. But really, it's not all going to go into the pasta. A lot of it's going to go down the drain. And you'll never get the right flavor by adding the salt later to the sauce. You have to add it in the water, and it has to get into the pasta. There's a metric formula that every Italian knows, not necessarily to repeat the exact numbers of, but knows instinctively. And it's 10 grams of coarse salt, not fine salt. You use half as much fine salt. 10 grams of coarse salt to a liter of water to 100 grams of pasta. So for a pound of pasta, you use about 5 quarts of water and 3 tablespoons of coarse salt, or as I said, half that amount of fine table salt. You can adjust that a little for your blood pressure or for your personal taste, but it's not just a pinch. It's not just a few grains. It's a substantial amount of salt.
My hand is about the size I
yes,
I use. Right?
Exactly. I can grab just about a tablespoon
Right. Well, that's and that is something that will make all the anything else that follows would miss.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so this is the most important first step. And so many people, and of course, you know, nothing more annoying than going into a restaurant and getting ordering a, what you think is going to be this wonderful bowl of pasta, and all you can see is a big circular mound of sauce. Where's the pasta? It's and they people believe it's all about the sauce.
People believe that pasta exists as a vehicle for sauce. It's quite the other way around. The sauce is in Italian. They're all not all the sauces are really sauces because sometimes it's just a handful of pork or a handful of cheese, and collectively they're all known as condimenti, condiments. The pasta is the main attraction. In fact, the other night I made this beautiful puttanesca. My husband loves pasta alla puttanesca, so I made it with all the most perfect capers from Pantelleria and the best anchovies I could lay hands on and the most wonderful olives. And I sat back and waited for the praise. And he said, "Oh, this is very good." And I smiled, I beamed, and then I realized he was talking about the pasta under all those that garlic and the hot pepper and the anchovies. He was tasting the pasta, and he recognized that that was a very good pasta, and that is a very Italian approach. He's Italian, and that's, and he's absolutely right. The pasta is it.
That's the other dressing. And that's the important lesson in that is that, you know, people say, "Oh, I'll just get any old pasta because I'll make a really good sauce." No, you have
absolutely
to really watch. If you don't make your own pasta, then you buy the best pasta you can.
Yes, yeah. Yes, absolutely. You buy extruded through bronze. Many people don't. I thought everybody knew that by now, but many people don't understand or don't even know it exists. Pasta that is, we're talking about the dry pasta, industrially made dry pasta. Whether it's made semi-artisanally in a small factory or in a huge factory, the material through which the pasta is extruded changes the texture of the pasta. And you want a rough surface. Ideally, the surface should be rough. And this is usually achieved with a bronze dye. It will say so on the package. People ask me, "How will I know it's..." You will read it, because if they're using bronze dyes, they want you to know.
That's right. They'll charge a little more. They'll tell you.
But really, on the scale of things, it's still a bargain.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Read the labels. Slow drying at low temperature makes a better pasta. You don't want the bigger the company. I won't mention any names, but the bigger the company, the more likely the pasta is blast dried at high temperature, because I mean, they just materially couldn't give all that attention to the enormous output. But smaller producers can have the luxury of drying at low temperature.
Well, that is the other myth that I think there. You have lots of them that you address, but one that so many Americans, I think, who haven't traveled, still ascribe to, and that is. But of course, to eat pasta like an Italian, you must twirl it on a big soup spoon.
No. People get very worked up over this and say, "Well, my grandmother always used a spoon." Maybe so, but good manners today, and certainly for the last 50 years, you don't use a spoon. You use a fork. And if you need to lean your fork, the tines of your fork against something, you lean it against the side of your dish.
And then break it up that way, right?
Yeah. You twirl against the
dish. Or use your teeth, people. It tastes good. Put it in your mouth.
Yes.
Right.
Well, the secret is just take two spaghetti at a time.
Right. We are going to hear more about these myths and your busting explanations for them when we come back after a short break.
I've been singing all day, singing all night, singing 'cause I got this feeling and I know it's a mighty hard road. but we all gotta go. Yeah, we all gotta go. Moaning through the nights, moaning through the days, moaning cause I once had a love and now she's gone. Oh, don't you know she's gone? Oh, don't you know she's gone? And she ain't coming back. Laughing through the nights, crying through the days, losing my mind one tear at a time over you. It's all over you, over you. A girl, I wish you knew. Who was in the right, who was in the wrong?
Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Maureen Font, and Maureen is the author of the co-author of Sauces and Shapes, Pasta the Italian Way with Oretta Zanini De Vita, and she's authored so many more books, but we're talking pasta today. And actually, some of the myths that we were talking about, the myths that abound in pasta cooking and in eating and making, and we were talking about twirling the pasta with a spoon. There are times you would use a spoon, but that's because the pasta's
soup.
It's soup. It's in broth. And you just said the only way to eat
angel hair is in broth.
And tortellini as well?
Tortellini only in broth. If my esteemed friend and co-author, Oretta, ever saw some of the uses of tortellini in this country, she would have apoplexy. She has apoplexy for much less, and she really might keel over.
and I'm guilty. She would have to come and arrest me. I am guilty.
Tortellini and pasta salad. The pasta salad doesn't officially exist in Italy.
That hot and cold should not come together, right? Oh, pasta and salad always go together. That was one of the myths. Pasta and salad.
Oh, right. That's if you have pasta and salad for dinner, it's a two-course meal. First the pasta, then the salad.
Salad
nothing
afterwards.
Alongside, right. No side dishes with pasta.
Right, right. Well, everyone has a question about pasta and how to cook it, how to eat it. And even our executive producer, Jack, came out and said he has a question. He said, what about the times, the cooking times on pasta? Are the directions on the box usually accurate?
Well, they have improved in recent years. They used to be sort of lottery numbers that you didn't. You couldn't trust them. Now they're pretty good, and you still have to set your timer for a minute or two early and check. But they're pretty trustworthy, and often they'll give you a choice between times. The longer time is if you're going to put it directly in a serving bowl and put the sauce on top, and the shorter time if you're going to finish in a pan. So, they're pretty good. They're pretty good, but you still have to be vigilant.
And people have all kinds of what they claim to be perfect methods to knowing when the pasta is perfectly done. One involves slinging it against the kitchen wall to see if it sticks or not.
I remember that when I was a child. Sophia Loren was guilty of that. She wrote a cookbook, and she said, and everybody for years after had pieces of spaghetti up on their ceiling that they could never get down. But no, that is not the way. By the time it sticks to the wall, it's already gone.
It's going to turn to mush, yeah. Well, you mentioned that take it off a little early if it's going to be finished in a pan, or depending on when you're going to put the sauce on, or what kind of sauce it is. And this is another thing that a lot of people don't understand, that they will serve a bowl of pasta and then put the sauce on.
Well, people are too slow with the sauce. That's a major difficulty. Once the pasta has been drained, every nanosecond counts. And you get it into a warm serving bowl.
Did you hear that, folks? Drained. Not rinsed. Drained.
Oh, you know, we don't rinse.
We don't even talk about it.
And assuming you're using a good bronze extruded pasta, don't worry if it's drained perfectly. If it carries a little water with it, it's going to be absorbed. These pastas are very absorbent, and they'll absorb a lot of sauce too. So you have to get it mixed up with the sauce. We put the cheese on first, except if you're doing it in a pan and you sort of physically can't. But if you're putting it in a serving bowl, add the cheese first. It sticks better and makes everything creamier. And then the sauce. But mix everything very well and very quickly, because you don't want it to get cold.
And as my husband, who's Italian, he had a grandmother who didn't like pasta in America unless she made it. Or if I made it.
Oh, well, that was quite an honor.
It was such a compliment. She said, because you don't, it's only what clings to the noodle a little bit. There's not too much sauce.
Yes.
And that was the whole thing, not too much sauce, as you said before. And you said put the cheese on first and then the sauce, because it'll get creamier, which brings me to another myth so many people believe. And listen, there are so many recipes that are, you know, famous old-time historical recipes that people have bastardized, you know, left and right. One of them is fettuccine Alfredo.
Yes. Alfredo. There is... Many people will go so far as to say it's not an Italian dish. It's certainly not a common Italian dish, but it is Italian. There's the Alfredo was a Roman restaurateur. There is a dish in Rome called fettuccine Alfredo, also known as fettuccine al triplo burro, triple butter. It has two ingredients besides the pasta. Butter, approximately a ton, and freshly grated Parmigiano, 24-month-old Parmigiano Reggiano, another ton. I think it's about a pound. We have, Oretta went to the restaurant and where they're still doing it, and they're about to introduce courses on it because people have just bastardized it so much. There is no cream in Alfredo.
Did you hear that? No cream.
I will repeat that. There is no cream in fettuccine Alfredo. There are most certainly not chicken breasts and anything else. Mushrooms. I have seen people put garlic in what they call Alfredo. Garlic and all that Parmigiano and all that butter would never happen in Italy. It just isn't recognized by the Italian palate as a good thing. But fettuccine Alfredo is a lot of butter, a lot of Parmigiano, and the thinnest, most delicate, freshly made fettuccine egg noodles that you can manage. And it's made very quickly. You have the butter just melting by the side of the stove when you drain the pasta. And it uses quite a bit of the pasta water as well to get the cheese all distributed. I think everybody should taste this once. Once is about all anybody really could handle in a lifetime. But when we were testing it for the book, we had some guests over at Oretta's house. And everybody, these were all Italians, everybody said, wow, the Parmigiano is so strong. And these were people who certainly had grown up with the taste of Parmigiano. It was nothing new about it. But that intensity of Parmigiano, it was almost too much. And I think everybody should make this recipe once and taste that intensity of Parmigiano, because once you've tasted that, you will never again overdo it with the cheese. You will recognize the power of Parmigiano and how it will take over the whole show. Mm-hmm. So it must be used sparingly. When it's called for, it's called for. It's good. It's wonderful. It's the best cheese in the universe. But it's strong stuff, and you have to keep it at bay, or you won't taste anything else.
But with the Alfredo, as it's stirred with the hot pasta and the melted butter, it does form its own cream sauce. I mean, it's cheese.
It's
melted. It becomes melted cheese.
Creamy and dreamy. Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. But that's the cheese and butter combining with the water from the pasta, the starch from the pasta. That's what makes it creamy. Yeah. It's
There's
not cream.
Another dish that is... remarkably simple that is often mismade, I mean, there are many, I'm sure, is spaghetti alla carbonara.
When I first went to Rome as a student, my then boyfriend, later ex-husband, and I met there in Rome at school, and we came back to New York and made carbonara for our friends. They were amazed. I would be probably embarrassed today with what I made in 1968 as carbonara. But nonetheless, one friend told me years later, he said, "You remember that time you invited me for dinner for carbonara?" And I said, "Of course I do." He said, "You know, I was really embarrassed for you all evening because I thought you forgot the sauce." If it wasn't red, it wasn't sauce.
That's right.
That was early carbonara. People tend to use cream in carbonara. That is it's essentially a cheat. It's not correct. It's not, you know, it's a mortal sin, but it's a venial sin. It helps you sort of move everything around. If you're using only egg yolks, as the more shishi tend to do, you need it because it's a little dry. But it's a traditional dish of poverty. It's people, shepherds and workers who went out in the mountains of the Apennines and took their pork with them in their little bags and cooked outdoors.
And not a rich cut of pork either.
No, they took guanciale, which was the...
jowls of the...
The jowl, the cured, not smoked, never smoked, which is why bacon is inappropriate, but... salt cured. And they cooked it themselves. So, you know, when it comes to separating the eggs, what were they going to do? Whip up a meringue with what they didn't use? No, the traditional way is to use the whole egg. Now, carbonara is one of these poor dishes that has gone uptown and all the fancy restaurants serve it and they use fancy cheeses. And it should be only pecorino romano, but parmigiano is good and it's widely accepted. But they use fancy cheeses, fancy peppers, and
when it's really
egg
just
yolks.
So simple,
it's really so simple. The secret to carbonara is temperature. You don't want to scramble the eggs, so you don't put anything back on the fire after you've added the eggs. And if the eggs are a little runny, so be it. Add more cheese if it's too runny for your taste. It'll absorb.
Right. And a lot of pepper. You got to add a lot of
pepper. And good freshly ground black pepper.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. You, in this book, you do as was, of course, the whole content of the book, the encyclopedia of pasta that you translated with Oretta. But this one, you include a whole section on different pastas and the making of them, and I guess it's a glossary, but it also tells a little bit how they're made too. There's one pasta shape that really surprised me. Not a pasta shape so much, but a pasta, and that is the pasta with pizza dough or bread dough.
Yes, that's traditional in where Oretta has her country house in Sabina, northern Lazio, the province of Rieti. There are, and it's not the only one, there aren't a lot of them, but there are some. You can go to in those towns or even in Rome, you can go to the bakery and just buy the dough, and then you take it home and roll it out and cut it into strips and boil them.
Hmm. So it makes a chewier, a chewier.
Yes, it's a different texture. Yes,
yeah, interesting. You had mentioned that you know the carbonara was a poor dish. Well, many of the pasta dishes that come from the Lazio region are more or less cucina povera. I mean,
yes,
they are foods of the, you know, of people without a lot of means, not buying fancy ingredients, but doesn't mean they're not good ingredients.
No, they're probably the best.
Right. One, as far as a shape and a sauce that where you find a travesty other than the tortellini, we've dealt with that one. Let's say you make a ragu, any kind of ragu, whether it's a lamb or beef or, so what would that be served with?
Well, let's take bolognese. Bolognese is served with tagliatelle. It is also used in lasagna bolognese, and that's it. Bolognese does not go on spaghetti. The bolognese, until probably the advent of television, didn't even know what spaghetti meant. It wasn't on their radar. And, you know, there's inherent... It's not that spaghetti is inherently horrible with meat sauce. It's just not traditional for this meat sauce, which is a very thick meat sauce, and it's nicely captured by the flatness of the noodle. Other ragouts from other parts of Italy where spaghetti is traditional are fine with spaghetti. We don't mind. We don't object to that.
And you heard it from the pasta police, right?
You heard it from the pasta police.
But in truth, the tagliatelle in Italy, except apart from a lot of the popular dried brands, is a little wider than what we see in the tagliatelle in the United States.
Oh, now that I don't know.
Yeah.
But the bolognese, Oretta is bolognese. So when she talks about the bolognese, she knows what she's talking about. She says they do tend to be obsessive. And they have registered not only the recipe for ragu and the filling for tortellini. These are registered with the local Chamber of Commerce. They also registered the permissible dimensions of the tagliatelle. And I don't remember how many millimeters it is, but it's some fraction of some tower in Bologna. I mean, it's practically a joke, except that they like that. That's the kind of thing that makes them laugh. They think that that's a good joke. Everybody else thinks it's crazy. But fettuccine and tagliatelle are essentially the same thing. But fettuccine might be a hair's breadth wider and a hair's breadth thicker.
And then we get up to pappardelle.
And pappardelle are wider. Are
right.
wider.
All right. So if I
and also very good with meat.
Another ragu with meat.
Yeah.
Like a lamb or a boar very particularly.
Good with,
yeah.
Very good with yeah. that. Wild boar. It's traditional with wild boar.
Okay. I'm getting hungry here. So let me throw out a couple of shapes to you and you tell me.
Oh, dear. Let's
I remember this. Right. No, I'm not going to throw anything out of left field. It's in your book. But what would be appropriate? How to serve these particular shapes? Okay. So I'm thinking of two that could be somewhat similar, and that would be garganelle and strozzaprete.
Oh, those are pretty versatile shapes. You can really do quite a lot with both of those. Garganelle are tubular, and they're good with meat sauce. They're good with meat sauce. They're good with really anything. And strozzaprete are...
Choke the priest for anyone who doesn't know.
Yes, if anybody doesn't know, recognize immediately. It comes from sort of resistance by stars to the papal states. It's when the Vatican had the Pope had the temporal power over most of central Italy. And the priests were regarded as sort of the gluttonous minions of the wealthy Vatican. But... Tomato sauces with a little meat, not the heavy ragouts like bolognese, but something that spreads over it, something with more tomato. Truffle, sometimes in Orvieto you see them with truffle sauces.
The garganelle.
The strozzaprete. But they call them something else. The nomenclature is really sort of fluid. But really, those are local products.
Mm-hmm. And then you travel from region to region throughout Italy, and there are specialties in different regions. I'm thinking of not cordelli, but the ones that are stamped, the round.
Corsetti,
right?
There are two kinds of corsetti. There's the ones that are stamped that look like communion wafers.
Right, they're small disc, a small disc of dough.
They're not even that small. They're thin disc. Okay. And they're stamped, and you could even have your family crest on the stamp. So you could stamp it with your...
That would take some work.
No, but there are people who make these now.
I'm thinking for mine.
Oh, yeah, right. And I forget what kind of sauce they use with those. Mm-hmm. I really do. I just can't remember. And then the other is crostetti made by hand, which are thicker and a little more rustic. But you start with a roll of flour and water dough, and you cut it off, and then you press your fingers together. And
so would you use that sort of like an orecchiette? Or
they could use the same. Orecchiette is typical with broccoli, and you could do the same.
Interesting.
Even though they're from different areas.
You tell in the book, you do tell an interesting tale, a story of basically pasta has to not be mushy and cooked right, and so some of the pastas were too large. They would, by the time they were cooked through, they would be too mushy. So they so they made tubular pastas. But tell me about that and how a home cook made this tubular pasta.
And still today, in many parts of the South, women are very skilled with this incredibly, I think it's very difficult technique. To make, for example, the original bucatini, everybody knows bucatini today as a thick spaghetti with a very thin hole down the middle. The original, which is extruded industrially, the original bucatini and fusilli and other shapes, long and short and more and less spirally, you take a rod, a metal rod that's not round like a knitting needle, ideally. It's square in section, which makes it easier to remove the pasta afterwards. And you take your little glob of dough. These are flour and water shapes, not egg, durum wheat and flour and water. You take a little glob of dough and you put it on the board. You have to use a nice wooden board. You place the rod on top of it, and you take your two hands and you start rolling vigorously and pushing the dough down the rod as you roll. So you create a tube, and you can do a short one or a long one. You know, a bigger glob of dough makes a longer, you can get that a longer. And then you give it a whack on the palm of your hand and ease the rod out. So you're making these one at a time. I think it's excruciating. But I have a friend from Basilicata who does it not with a rod, but with a straw. And she gave me a handful of these straws to play with. I tried and I gave up. But she makes these delicate fusilli. The original fusilli are these, not the corkscrews that we see, the industrial fusilli. And it makes a very thin, she can make with the straw, she can make a very thin tube. And absolutely, absolutely delicious. And women today are still, she's younger than me. Not that that means anything, but she has absolutely the traditional technique.
Well, and you even mentioned that Aretha still uses her grandmother's.
Her
mother-in-law's.
Because Aretha's grandmothers were from the north. But her mother-in-law was from Basilicata. And Aretha has her mother-in-law's. Ferretto, it's called.
Mm. Well, there is so much we could talk about on pasta forever and ever. Well, because it's very close to my heart, and you have such wonderful, wonderful information and tales to tell. I just encourage people to to look in the books.
Oh,
and,
thank you.
And just to illustrate what a pasta police you are. And all about this fact that the pasta has to be dressed immediately, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And if you have any put away in the refrigerator or for later that has no sauce on it?
Yeah, it has to be thrown away. It's not fit for human consumption.
Not fit for human consumption.
There are things you can do with leftover sauced pastas, and those we have a little epilogue in the book called The Day After. But if you haven't sauced it,
Throw it away.
Absolutely, right? Throw it away.
And you heard it from the pasta policewoman herself, Maureen Fant. Maureen, thank you so much.
It was truly a pleasure, Linda.
And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.